This is the third shiur in Rav Dessler's Neis V'Teva, Miracle and Nature. Yesterday we went round and round the bend. I'd like to get back to the text again. Rav Dessler has argued that cause and effect are terms that don't have a meaning for us. They don't describe anything unless they talk about patterns of events. They don't say anything about the inner workings of the events. In particular, we have no concept of what it would mean to say that one thing forces another thing to happen. We just know that when things of one type happen regularly, they're followed by things of a second type. Stones hitting windows with certain momentum, windows of a certain type, when windows go to pieces. But that's all we have. So, Rav Dessler goes on, second page of the essay, the truth is that there's no difference between what we call miracle and what we call nature at all. Everything is miracle. The whole world, there's no cause for anything to happen other than God's will. And His will is His actions and His anhaga, means His governing, controlling, organizing. Everything exists through His will. Just as we call miracle something where God's will brings about something which we're not used to, and that newness, unexpected element, has an effect on us to see in it God's hand. What we call nature is where His will operates in a constant fashion with one rule, and we become used to it, we become accustomed to it. And this constancy in God's will creates the possibility of testing people. If even when the events that take place do follow rules, they do have patterns, they are constantly similar, whether we'll see that as God's will also, or whether we will think that God handed over the universe to the control of something else. And the difference between the two views will be this. If God handed over the events to something else and that thing is operating on its own, then man has leverage by making use of that power operating on its own for man to create consequences. Whereas, if God is causing every event to take place, then man has no leverage whatsoever. The appearance of cause and effect is like a magic trick. It's a mistake. And then, people will understand that they're not bringing about any effects at all. Now, there's a lot packed into this paragraph, and I want to try to explain at least some of it. First of all, it's something which you have to get used to. The word miracle in our literature means two different things. And even the same writer can use the word in two different ways. And sometimes in the same essay it can be used two different ways. Sometimes even in the same paragraph it can be used two different ways. And you just have to get used to it. Sometimes miracle means what I said to you yesterday, an event in which God's agency shows You can see God doing it. Not that you have to believe He's doing it, not that you're taught that He's doing it, not that our sources say that He's doing it, but you can see that He's doing it. I'll give you an example of where that usage is where it appears. There's a halacha. Let's say you have a place where you were and a miracle occurred to you. Let's say you were in mortal danger and your life was saved. The Shulchan Aruch says every time you go past that place again, you have to make a blessing for the fact that God did for you a miracle in that place. You're driving your car up a narrow mountain road and you lose control of the car and it breaks through the guardrail and goes over the cliff. And at the same time, your door flies open and you are ejected from the car and your coat is caught on the branch of a tree and you're saved. Every time you drive past that spot on the road, you have to make a blessing because God did a miracle for you at that spot. Clearly, when the halacha says that every time you go past a place where God did a miracle for you, the picture is that miracles happen very, very rarely. If you took a drink at a water fountain, you don't have to make a blessing every time you walk past the water fountain. If you went to a vending machine where you get money out of your account, and you punched in the code and $100 came out, you don't have to make a blessing every time you walk past that money vendor. This halacha means that miracles are very, very rare. Because a miracle is an event in which God shows His agency, where it can't be denied. Where it's obvious. That's one use of the word miracle. And that means that miracles are very rare. Now, in the Siddur, in the next to last blessing, we talk about God's miracles that are with us constantly, evening, morning, and afternoon. What's that? That's not the miracles for which the halacha says to make this blessing. It's a different use of the word. There, the word means events that are brought about by God's direct will. And that, according to what Rav Dessler is telling us, is everything. If what you mean by miracle is just an event that God brings about directly by His will, that's everything, leaving aside free will of a human being. Everything is that. Then it's not rare, it's universal. So you just have to be careful when a person writes miracle or nace in Hebrew to pay attention and think to yourself, what does he mean? In this paragraph, when Rav Dessler says nace, what he means is an event that's brought about by God's will. And therefore he says, the conclusion we've arrived at is that everything is miraculous. Since cause and effect mean nothing other than patterns, patterns in what? Patterns in the events that God creates. Patterns in the events that God causes. So that being the case, every event is directly brought about by God, and that being the case, if you use miracle in that minimal sense of being brought about directly by God, you can say that everything is miraculous. Rav Dessler, a little bit further on, uses the following analogy, and this analogy I think is good to keep in mind because it really says it very clearly and very vividly. You know what a moving picture is. A film, I don't know what you call them today. A moving picture is just many, many, many pictures. And they are projected so rapidly that you don't see them as separate pictures. You see it as one continuous action. Used to be 16 a second, 24 a second, I don't know how many they have today. But each picture is an entirely separate picture. And physically, each picture is entirely distinct from every other picture. It happens that in a commercial film, there's a producer, and he organizes the pictures so that they'll end up telling a coherent story. If you selected them at random, it wouldn't make any sense at all. When I was young, about a million years ago, for a short period of time, they experimented with subliminal advertising. That meant you'd be watching a film about cowboys riding their horses, and then there would be a single frame, get a Coke. Just a single frame. Now, going by at 16 frames per second, you couldn't see and recognize and consciously read Get a Coke, but your subconscious mind got it. And at that point in the film, everybody went out and got Cokes. They were suddenly thirsty. Well, of course, after it was discovered, it became outlawed. A person should make a conscious decision to buy something, not be manipulated by subliminal advertising. But what does this illustrate? This illustrates that you have a picture of people on horses riding. The producer can stick in a picture that says, buy a Coke, and then go on to pictures about. Each picture is an entirely separate reality. It's an entirely separate object. Just that they're organized into a pattern that makes it easy for your mind to experience as a continuous action. Says Rav Dessler, our world is like a film. Every moment is a separate creation. It's a brand new creation. There's no real connection between any moment and any other moment. That's going to be the ultimate idea, that there's no such thing as cause and effect. They're only patterns. Because each moment is a separate creation. Only, God creates these moments according to a pattern where the moments are so similar to one another that our minds integrate the pattern into continuous events, continuous action. But it's really a mistake. It's really a mistake. You look at the table, moment by moment, it's a brand new table. Only, each moment, it's very similar to the moment before. Not quite identical. You move your head to the reflection of the light from the table, changes its position on the table. There are slight variations, but they're so minimal that your mind integrates it into one continuous action as if there were a single thing that continued to exist. But just as in the movie picture, in the film, it's an illusion. It's really separate frames. Our world is also an illusion. It's separate creations, moment by moment. That's why there's no such thing as cause and effect. Cause and effect means what happens now has a connection to what happens in the next minute and forces it to occur, makes it occur, necessitates its occurring. Once you realize that each moment is a separate creation, there can't be any such connection any more than in a film. When you have one snap, one picture, you would say that this picture caused the next picture to occur. There's no physical connection between the pictures at all. Each picture is put there by the producer in order to have effect. So, this is the picture of the world, how it really is, and we don't see it that way. And Rav Dessler says that this thereby gives us an opportunity for a test. Let me insert a footnote here, which is important here, and it's important in the age of the universe and other places as well. When you look at the world, you don't see this. We don't see the world being recreated moment by moment. Maybe the re is not appropriate there, that's a separate issue. We don't see God creating the world moment by moment. We don't see that each moment is a separate creation. Does that mean that God is fooling us, misleading us, systematically casting us into superstition and mistake and ignorance and illusion? As one otherwise very competent philosopher put it in the context of evolution, are we to think of God as a jokester? You know, making the world one way and showing it to us another way and making it impossible for us to know the truth about the world? This is a mistake. This whole line of thought is a mistake. I didn't appreciate it appropriately until my teacher, Rabbi Moshe Meiselman, pointed it out to me. God told us the truth. He told us the truth. So there's no illusion, there's no superstition, there's no mistake, there's no misinformation. We know the truth because he told us. Only in this respect, he created the world in such a way that you can't see with your eyes the truth that he told us is going on. But he didn't leave us in ignorance. He revealed it to us. Now, this means that God will create the world in such a way that it doesn't look like what it really is. You can't deny that. It's impossible to deny that. Once you acknowledge that God is making the world moment by moment, He's making the world moment by moment, and you know we don't see that. It's clear that He is making the world in such a way that you can't see what it really is. That's undeniable. So then when you use that idea for the age of the universe and other things, it's not a strange idea, it's not a foreign idea, it's not what they call ad hoc, it wasn't made up in order to solve the difficulty of the differences of the ages of the universe. It's an idea that's central to all Jewish thinking. And it applies wherever it applies. Okay, now, since we don't see the world operating that way, we see the world as one continuous operation. If we rely on our eyes, we'll be led into the mistake of cause and effect. That's why we started with cause and effect. That's why the people with whom Rav Dester imagined having the conversation at the outset will say, nature is cause and effect because the cause makes the effect take place. Because that's the way it looks. Okay, L'may Nafka Mina, what difference does it make whether you go with the false appearance that there really is cause and effect, that things really happen because other things happen, they make them happen? Or whether you internalize, as we will see, Rav Dester wants it to be internalized in a very dramatic way, you internalize the truth that every moment is a separate creation. What difference does it make? Let me just finish this thought, and then I'll take a question. He says the difference is to test the human being. If you thought that the universe ran on its own, if you believe that cause and effect are real, then when you make an effort to control the world and generate an output, if you're successful, then you did it. Your ego gets a big boost because you accomplished it. Whereas, if you recognize the truth that every moment is a separate creation, so I studied and I stayed up all night working and I used all my energy and resources, and then the result came, I didn't produce a result. Nothing that happens in this world can produce anything. I went through all those motions and God gave it to me as a gift. That's an entirely different experience. Let me give you an analogy to make it perhaps more, you know, closer to your world. A computer company advertises that they're going to hire people for a job. And these have to be people who are experienced in programming. And they're going to run a competition. And the winners in the competition will be hired. What's the competition? They've designated a particular programming language. And they want you to write a program that will do a certain job in that language. It's quite a complicated job, quite a subtle job. You have a whole week to do it. They'll pay your salary for the week. They give you a computer. And you have to write the program. And at various stages in writing the program, you can test it, and you can run diagnostics on it to see how it's doing and do the best you can. Good. There are 100 people who are in this competition. They're competing for 3 places, and you take your place. You know, you also compete. You write the program, and you try, and it has problems and bugs, and it goes off. And you run diagnostics, and you run tests, and you change it, and rework it, and by the end of the week, you have a running program. And you feel, well, I guess I have a chance. You know, maybe other people wrote more efficient programs, more sophisticated programs. My program is running. You feel pretty good about it. Next week, you get a call. You've been chosen. You're one of the 3 who's been chosen for the job. You come down, and you know, you're full of joy. You got the job, and you succeeded in the test, and everything else. And then they tell you, we want you to know that the whole test was a setup. The program you wrote was terrible. It didn't run at all. What was going on is this. When you wrote the program, the results of your writing were shown on a screen to a master programmer. And the basis of the mistakes you were making, he sent you back false results. Your program didn't run at all. He sent you back false results to see how you would deal with those results. And in each case where you made improvements, so then he sent you back more false results to see how you would deal with these results and those results. That's how you're being tested. but really, your program didn't run at all. It's just that the way in which you dealt with the false results showed us that you have the talent to be trained for the job that we want to do. Don't you feel deflated now? Ha! Oh, my program didn't run. It was really a flop. It didn't work. Okay, I have talent. Obviously, they hired me, not the 97 other people. But still, the program didn't run. Correct. You feel deflated. Now you have an insight into why people want to believe in cause and effect. They want to believe in cause and effect. Because if cause and effect is real, and I take advantage of it, then I produce the results. I'm a success. My ego can take credit for what I've done. Whereas, the minute I recognize that there is no cause and effect, that everything's produced by God, and He's giving it to me, of course, He's giving it to me on the basis of what I do, but what I do isn't producing it. Who knows what His calculations are in giving it to me? Maybe just so I won't give up hope. Or on the other hand, maybe He's taking somebody and leading him down the path to destruction. Who knows what his calculations are? Everything has to be recognized as being a gift from God. When I succeed and when I fail. It isn't I who succeeded. It isn't I who failed. I did XYZ, and God gave me a result of A or gave me a result of B. And that's my next challenge, to deal with the result that God gave me. So it's the ego that desires to see the world as cause and effect. Let me expand on this a little bit. Again, I don't know whether Rodester had access to, through his students, what went on in the 17th, 18th century philosophy. There are two stages in which people learn about and become committed to cause and effect. One is you watch the world around you. A lot of what happens in the world doesn't look like cause and effect. It doesn't have any obvious explanation at all. But some of it does. Billiards. The ball goes, the bangs on that ball, and it goes off at that angle, that one goes in the pocket, that one bangs off the side. And it happens regularly, and you see it happening. This was the theater picture of science. I'm watching the world and taking note. This turned out to be an extremely limited picture. A great deal of science is not watching the world, but manipulating the world, smashing the world, burning the world, dissolving it with acids, you know, twisting it around to see what will happen. It was interactive, not just observational. So watching the world and seeing its patterns can lead a person to expect the patterns and think in terms of cause and effect. Much more seductive is when you're investing in the world, when you're taking advantage of the patterns. You're following the patterns and you're getting certain results. There the ego is involved. The ego wants to see that the patterns are real cause and effect, real forcing, because then the ego can take credit. Now, says Rodester, God has plunged us into this world with the ego functioning full strength. We have to make things happen in the world. Footnote. Unlike Adam, who didn't have this challenge, we have this challenge. At some point or other, we'll have to coordinate all this with Adam and his transgression. But unlike Adam, we are plunged into the world, and we have to interact with it in such a way that we survive. So the temptation to see cause and effect as real is gigantic. And the test is, in spite of it, to see, and as we'll come to appreciate, see is not quite enough of a word, it's a much more elaborate conception, take the world as a divine production. Questions up to here, because I have one more qualification. Everyone, questions up to here.
It's interesting, the ego, what causes the ego?
What causes the ego?
How can one, with that knowledge,
okay, I'll come to both of these when I talk about Adam's test. You know, they're both good questions, but I'll talk about when I come to Adam's test, yeah.
This may sound strange, but the fact that the world is a constant new creation every millisecond or every second, If Hashem's perfect in every way, then why didn't he just create the world so by its one word for a certain amount of years? Why does it need to constantly be remade every second?
Why does God make it anew every second? Why doesn't he create it, what, so that it should run on its own? Okay, you haven't been here from the beginning, but first of all, we've been through Rav Dessa's argument that the words run on its own don't describe any meaningful reality that we can understand. So, when you ask, why didn't he do it? There's no it to talk about, from Rav Dessa's point of view. But as a matter of fact, the Ramchal asks your question in an essay which is not translated into English called Ma'amar al HaChokhmah. He asks your question. He says, sort of waiting for somebody to lower the boom here. There's a subtle contradiction of what I'm saying. I'm not gonna tell you what it is. If you don't find it, I'm not gonna tell you what it is. And we have plenty of time. You can get it next week also. He says, God is all powerful. Why does he make the world new every moment? Why doesn't he make it and let it run on its own? He can do anything. Why doesn't he do that? Now, I must tell you, I don't know anybody else who asks this question. This is why I say that the Ramchal is basically a philosopher. This is a philosopher's question. Now, there are many, many other areas in which the Ramchal showed himself to be basically a philosopher. At any rate, his answer is this. The purpose of our existence in the world is dveikus. Dveikus means being attached to God. Okay, God isn't a brick wall that you can attach yourself to him with glue. What does being attached to God mean? For us, what we have of God, what we can understand of God, what exists of God in our world is his will. If he creates the world and lets it run on his own, that means his will is absent. If his will is absent, he's not available to be attached to. By creating the world moment by moment, he makes himself available. He's present in the only way in which God is present, namely, his will creates our world. There's nothing more about him that can be present. So the Ramchal makes this an expression of the purpose of man's creation. And now that I think of it, I'm very happy to ask the question because this leads to another footnote that I have to put in, a qualification, but maybe this will help. Maybe this will help. That'll be very nice if it helps. I told you Rav Dessa's picture is that we're creating the world, God's creating the world moment by moment, brand new. Does that include everything? Or might there be an exception? I think there has to be an exception. And the exception is the human soul. And the reason it has to be an exception is this. With the picture of the film, separate creations, brand new moment by moment, when I speak about this table, the word this is a bit ambiguous. Because every moment it's a new table. Every moment it's brand new. Created ex nihilo. Now, if you thought that was true of the soul as well, you're going to run into a moral problem. In the end, there's reward and punishment. You can only punish the agent who performed the action. Otherwise, it's immoral. It's unjust. Won't do to punish the agent's grandchild. It won't do because punishing him will be unjust. And reward, listen carefully, even though reward wouldn't be unjust, it would, you can give free gifts to whomever you please. There's nothing unjust in giving free gifts, but it's not reward. Reward means I'm compensating you for what you did. So there's got to be continuity. I live my life in certain years, and then the reward and the punishment, God forbid, but whatever it is, in the end, it's going to happen down the line. But it isn't the same one who did it. It isn't the same one who did it. By the way, if you're worried about what happens in the world to come, think about punishment in this world. There is punishment in this world for certain transgressions. If the soul is a brand new soul every minute, so I did something when I was 35, and now I'm 64. It's not me. I said, well, I'm me every moment, but it's not the me that did it. The me that did it is long gone, you know, 19 years ago, 29 years ago. You can't calculate anymore. So, in order for there to be real justice, seems to me that the soul has to be created once and continue. The soul has to be created once and continue. Unlike everything else in the world that can be created moment by moment. Now, I have asked this question to certain people who I respect. Everyone I've asked is inclined to agree with me. No one had a source for it. The natural association is that the soul is defined in our sources as a piece of God on high. Okay, piece doesn't mean slice. You can't slice God. But what it means is that it shares some essential characteristics with God. And just as God is uncreated altogether, it would be natural to say that the soul is once created and then continues. As God continues. It would be natural to say. And we have a necessity to say it for the sake of justice. Now, take what the Ramchal says in the Ma'amar al HaChokhmah that I quoted to you. He asks, why doesn't God create the world and let it go on its own? Why is he recreating it? Or maybe the re is wrong. Creating it every moment so as to be available for attachment, that we can attach to him. That doesn't require him to create the soul every moment. It requires him to be present in the world to which the soul is going to attach. So if I take his explanation and limit the phenomenon to his explanation, all that has to be created anew every moment, the only thing in which his will has to be operating all the time, is the world to which the soul is going to attach. God's will has to be present for the soul to attach to. It doesn't follow that God's will has to be creating the soul moment by moment. So that's pretty good. So I think maybe that helps. You know, it helps the idea. Yes.
When we say number one, we say that Hashem recreates the world every second, right? Does it mean he's recreating it from scratch, or he's giving new life to what is in existence already?
Okay, that's half the question.
If we say the latter, then a soul, we can say, it's not necessarily, you don't have to say that he creates it in the beginning and he keeps it going. You can say that there is that soul and he keeps on giving life, and therefore when the person dies, he stops giving life towards that thing, and that's why it dies.
Good. I'll repeat the question but that's excellent. That's really excellent. You ask, when we say that he's making the world, this is why I said over and over again, maybe the re is wrong, that's exactly what I was referring to. Is God recreating the world moment by moment, or is he creating it from nothing moment by moment? Is each moment a brand new creation ex nihilo? Which really is the analogy with the film. Each picture is a brand new picture. No picture is made out of the previous picture. Each one is a brand new frame. Or is it that he's recreating, giving life to the same thing continuously, so that it really is the same thing? He's just giving life to it moment by moment. Now, this is the natural question to ask, I think. I'm glad you asked it. Very interesting. In the Hebrew, in Siddur, the word is mechadesh. The English translates recreate. As far as I can tell, the word mechadesh has no re in it. Mechadesh means make new. When someone is mechadesh chidushim in Torah, it means he came up with new ideas, new insights, new explanations. Not that he took something old and continued it. He gave birth to something new. So, don't be hypnotized by the English translation in the Siddurim that says recreate. Now, I have discussed this point with other people as well. And although not everybody agrees with me on this one, I'll tell you what I think. I think that recreate used the phrase giving life. I think that was also very telling. Giving life to the same thing, and therefore would be the same thing from moment to moment, I think that idea is incoherent. Let me explain why. This is not easy to do, but I'll try to explain why. Imagine a thing, a box. And the box is white. But I have little flecks of black dust. And let's make it simpler. It's just a surface, not a box, a surface. And I have a directed gust of air, you know, a column of air, which is blowing the black flecks of dust against the surface. So that when you look at the surface, you see black. It looks black because of the flecks of dust. Now you could say, I'm creating the black color. I know black isn't the color. All right, make them blue. I'm creating the blue color of the surface with my gust of air and the blue flecks of dust. That's how I'm creating it. From moment to moment, it's the same flecks of dust. And it's the same color. But it's my column of air that's holding it there, and that's why the color is there. That's because the flecks continue to exist on their own. I'm just directing the air column which keeps them in position. I'm responsible for the position, but their existence of the flecks is independent. I'm not doing that. When you have something which exists on its own, and its existence is not in question, I can operate to give it a certain character, to create a property, to give it a certain structure. And then I can be operating all the time, and the fact that it's in that, has that character, that property, that structure, is what I'm doing all the time. Now contrast that with a Van de Graaff generator. You know what a Van de Graaff generator is? Imagine a big wooden frame, big, it's like 10 feet wide and 10 feet tall. And it has metal plates on it, surfaces of metal. Then you have a giant wheel that's attached to this frame. And on the wheel there are thin strips of metal, flexible thin strips of metal, like brushes, which are in contact with the plates. You turn the wheel. When you turn the wheel, the contact of the metal to the metal creates static electricity. And this frame has a pole connected to the metal of the frame, a metal pole, and another distance away, there's another metal pole, and when you build up enough static electricity, a spark jumps from one pole to the next pole. They do this every day in the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, and they hold up a big oak board, and the spark smashes through the oak board, and all the children who are watching become physicists. That's what it's for. Now, whoever's turning the wheel, by turning the wheel, he generates the static electricity which makes the spark. Shall we say that each turn of the wheel recreates, maintains, gives life to the spark? The spark? The same spark? But you know very well that this is a flow of electrons, and every electron is different from every other electron, and the flow, each moment, is a flow of different stuff, different substance. It only has the same form, and it has the same appearance, but the substance isn't the same. The substance is brand new every second. Here's where your action gives existence to something. When your action gives existence to something, to say that from moment to moment it's the same thing has no sense. It doesn't describe anything. To say that the X at one moment and the X at the second moment are the same X, it can't be that the first X was created out of nothing in the first moment, And the second X was created out of nothing in the second moment. If in each moment it's created out of nothing, then it's a brand new thing. Now, I don't know how to prove that other than to say it. To me, the intuition is absolutely clear. To have continuity, it can't be that you're creating it out of nothing. If you're creating it out of nothing, it's brand new. If you imagine a moment in which X doesn't exist, and then the next moment in which it does exist, because it's created at that moment, that means that it's brand new because it was created at that moment. So then you come to the next moment, the third moment. What do I care whether in moment two there was an X created out of nothing? Moment one, there wasn't an X created out of nothing. Moment three is a brand new moment. It's a brand new moment created out of nothing. So at best, all you can have is similarity between the X at moment two and the X at moment three. It can't be the very same, self-same X. Right? Because it's being created out of nothing. It can't be the self-same X. So I think that the idea of recreating the same thing out of nothing is a contradiction. I don't think it has any sense. Yeah.
Rabbi said that punishment can only be acceptable because the soul doesn't get recreated. Although everything in the physical world constantly being recreated, the soul isn't. Now, what seems to be somewhat logical is the fact that we don't know why the soul can't grow anymore, has no free will. So the soul has no free will. How does it have any reward or punishment? How can reward and punishment be linked to the soul? It can only be linked to the physical world.
I'll repeat your question, but now the end is I'm lost. You ask that if reward and punishment have to apply to a soul that's not created anew every moment, because it has to be applied to the one that performed the action.
It's not involved in the decision making process. So it's somewhat irrelevant.
What in the world to come?
In this world, let's say the soul's not connected to the decision making process.
Now you've switched the grounds altogether. You first started to get with a question about the world to come. Now you're back to this world without the world to come.
I'm just saying there's no free will. The soul doesn't have free will. Only the body has free will.
The soul has no free will. Only the body has free will. Why would you say that?
The soul has free will.
I would say certainly the soul has free will, and certainly the body doesn't. The body by itself is an animal. Animals don't have free will. We locate free will either in the soul or something that's associated with the soul. We don't locate it in the body. Body has no free will. Right? Free will and exercise of will is a spiritual event. It's not a physical event. That's for sure. Okay, so the idea of constant recreation is going to apply to the physical world. It's not going to apply to the soul. And in that way, this is another obvious question here, nobody's asking. All right, I'll do it just to finish up. What is a human being?
A human being is a combination of soul and body.
Combination of soul and body.
It's a combination of physical and non-physical.
Correct. Well, let's stop there. Just stop there. Now meditate for a second. Soul and body. That's what the human being is. So I made the soul an exception. Terrific! What about the body? I left the body in the physical world. The body then is being recreated, or I fall into that step myself, it's a mistake myself all the time. It's being created anew moment by moment. One second. The body is being created anew moment by moment. Isn't the reward, the punishment going to involve the body? What relevance does the body have to the reward and punishment if it isn't the same body? Couldn't you ask the same question about the body? I said it's only relevant if it's an agent that performed the action. Well, the agent wasn't a disembodied soul. The agent was a soul and a body together.
The agent chose to do the action by the body. The soul was like the commander-in-chief of the army.
Okay, I think we're getting close. I think we have to say something a little radical here, but I think I'm inclined to go in the direction that you're suggesting. The body is an application of the soul. The body is an implementation of the soul. The body is an expression of the soul.
Not
the soul is bodily expressed. It's expressed bodily. One shouldn't think perhaps of it as two separate things, like a radio and a flashlight, which you could have in one machine nowadays. You know, press this button, the light goes on. Press that button, you get music. Right? It's not a radio and a flashlight fused together. But bodiliness is a way in which the soul operates or expresses itself. Which would mean that the body shouldn't be thought of as a separate entity, although many write this way, including the Ramchal in various places. I'm citing the Ramchal someplace else. But it's a kind of adverb. This is how the soul operates under certain conditions. Why do I say that? Because in the Das Tfunos, which is translated, the understanding heart, when he describes the ultimate resolution of the soul and the body, he speaks of the body in a certain sense being absorbed into the soul. It becomes absorbed into the soul. The body becomes more and more soul-like. It loses its physical opposition to spirituality. It becomes more and more soul-like to the point where it becomes absorbed as merely a capacity of the soul. And eventually, it's not even a real capacity, it's only a memory. It's only a memory of a capacity. It becomes absorbed into... Now, the process at the end of things leading to the ultimate perfection reflects the process at the beginning of things by which things came into the world. There's nothing new under the sun. Here's another structural idea. History is like a U, a big U. God creates the world at the top of one leg. The world descends through various processes down to the bottom. God then brings it slightly up the other leg and leaves us to work. Our job is to push the world back up to the top, only this time we pushed it to the top. He didn't make it, but we made it. On the other hand, we're not at the depths of the U, because if we fail, we could slip backwards also. But you're not going to get any higher. You're not going to get any higher at the end of things than where you started from, where God started from in the creation. So our rectifying or perfecting the world is a reflection in reverse of the process of creating the world. Therefore, from the Ramchal's description of how the body will be rectified in the end, I think we can understand what the real character of the body is. The character of the body is a way in which the soul operates. Now, that way can become manifested in something which has its own laws, its own character, its own operating, but its significance is that it's a way that the soul operates. Not that it's an entirely separate thing. Now, a lot of work would have to be done to make this really clear and consistent. I'm just telling you the idea that I think is behind it. Yeah.